Another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler.
Hi, folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough. Or even if they don't dictate, it is almost always the case. During my 50-mile commute between Arlington and Frisco, Texas, today is Monday, December the 7th, 2009, Pearl Harbor Day, a day that will live in infamy because not everybody agrees to exactly how things went down, and we'll leave it at that. Anyway, today we're going to do our typical Monday, which means you guys have a bunch of questions for me. I have a bunch of answers for you, and hopefully they're good ones. Before we do that, though, we'll knock out the housekeeping for today. First and foremost, our sponsors of the day. Remember, you can see all of our sponsors by going to The Survival or TheSurvivalPodcast.com, depending on what part of the country you're from, whether you say the or the. There must be one of those in front of Survival Podcast or you won't get there. They're in our right-hand margin, and they are all personal endorsements and vetted by our moderators on the forum. Sponsor of the day number one, SOE Tactical Gear. These guys have been taking care of us from the very beginning. John Willis and his group build the toughest gear on the planet. I will not hesitate to say that. Do you want to own gear that when you're dead, your kids will use it? Do business with John. Next sponsor today, Backyard Food Production. Marjorie down in the Austin area have built a really an amazing little farm. An amazing system of support for themselves that feeds them. And it provides basically all their needs. They live as self-sufficient as I think it's possible to in today's day and age. They did it in a pretty harsh environment. The Hill Country is not an easy place to do this. And it's pretty amazing what they've done. They've put that all into a DVD that shows you how to do it. And I don't know why she hasn't jacked the price up yet, but I keep telling her to raise it at least $5. So I'd buy it now before you run out of the opportunity to get the DVD at a reduced price of $25. If you know anybody that's into gardening, farming, permaculture, great Christmas present. Check this disc out. It's pretty damn amazing. I've watched it 3 times now, and I'm still learning from it. All right, next, get involved with our forum. Leave it at that. Check out our YouTube channel. Subscribe. Last week, I did give away 2 free years to the Member Support Brigade to 2 different people, and that went really well, but you had to be a YouTube subscriber to subscribe. There's a video up there right now. It's not going to help you learn anything. It's just me and Ralph the cat eating some doves to Country Boy Can't Survive, and my wife grabbed the camera and shot it while I was sitting there feeding the cat. I wasn't even really aware at first that she was doing it, and it was just a fun little video. And check that out, and you can see how we treat our animals in the Spirico household. They're treated like family. Last, check out the gear shop. Sister Wolf and TW are running a special this week only on gear. It's a shirt, a large decal, a small decal, a patch, and a challenge coin for $35 or something like that. It's right on the main page, first thing listed. Check it out. It's a great deal. It saves you about 25%. And they're only going to run that deal for a week, so check it out. If you want to know what a challenge coin is, I'll tell you what a challenge coin is tomorrow, unless you want to look it up or you already know yourself, because I had a long show today. I got to get into this. But last but not least, consider joining the Member Support Brigade. Get exclusive content available only to members, including about $150 worth of stuff for free on day one. And your support, $5 a month or $50 a year. So I've really tried to make that thing pay the members back for supporting the show. I think I've done a good job, and I'll keep working on it. All right, with that, let's get into the main topic of today's show, which is, again, your questions. And the first question I'm going to do, it comes from a really long discussion that we've had on a couple episodes, back and forth with a few different people, about all the discussion we did about a week ago on climate change and global warming and cap and trade. I don't want to go down the rat hole of climate change again today. I don't want to try to explain it again today, and I'm not going to. I get weary of the people that drink the Kool-Aid and believe everything that they're told, especially those that don't believe anything they're told by mainstream except climate change. So let's just wash that away, and we can all talk about this today without worrying about whether CO2 raises global temperatures or not. It has nothing to do with cap and trade. But people don't understand it. I've been asked a lot about it. I wanted to do it one time and be done with it again, about what this is, how it works, what it does, and why it won't do anything that we're being told it will to curb our pollution, no matter what you believe about global warming. Doesn't even matter what you believe. Cap and trade is a scam. Okay? Again, believe whatever you want about the environment. It's not necessary for you to change your environmental beliefs to believe what I'm going to tell you right now. If you'll listen to me and let me explain this to you. People are asking me, how can cap and trade help them control the population? Why do they need it to control the population when they already have so many methods of control in place? And how does big business benefit from something that seems so anti-big business? In other words, how can you say all the money's behind it when there's really no money in it? It's because you don't understand what it is. Cap and trade takes carbon and people not using carbon. Those two worlds blends them together. And it takes carbon, and with the stroke of a pen and an agreement by the governments of the world and our government, makes carbon the largest traded commodity in the world. Carbon and carbon credits will become, overnight if this thing passes, the biggest commodity in the world. There'll be more carbon credits in dollars trading than oil, than gas, than food, than real estate. It becomes the biggest business in the world, and today it's about $120 billion business for the little places it's made inroads. Before this started, before man created it, it was worthless. It is another fiat currency. It's hard for you to understand, but let me put it to you this way. Let me break it down to a small level so it's easier to understand. Let's say I'm Jack's Widgets. And I produce widgets, and I don't create any carbon with my widgets. Or let's say that I have an allowance a year of 10. 10 doesn't mean to mean anything. Just I want you to understand how this works. So I have a 10 allowance for my business, and I only produce 5 carbon units. So I have a surplus of 5 carbon offsets. Okay, so I've been capped. That's the cap. I can only produce 10, right? But I have a surplus of 5. Now I get to trade. So Jim produces Jim's carbon widgets, and Jim has an allowance of 10 as well. But he uses 13 this year. He produces 13 units of emission. I sell 3 of my carbon credits to Jim. That's it. That's the whole thing on the surface. Now, it's not numbers like 10 and 13, though. It's numbers in the billions and the trillions of dollars. And my friends, how will that move money be moved around the world? Who will do it? The biggest banks in the world will do it. The banks are totally for cap and trade. Citibank, Bank of America, you don't believe me, go research it. Why? Because it puts trillions of dollars into circulation. And it takes a worthless thing, you sitting around doing nothing and not producing carbon, and turns it into currency. It makes money out of nothing. It's the Federal Reserve take two on a global scale. It creates a global fiat currency that's larger than all the other commodities traded in the world, and it does it overnight with the stroke of a pen. Now you tell me that's not a great way to control a population, because once you have that done, you have yet another carrot to dangle, another way to redistribute wealth. And what you need to understand about this, the other people that are saying, how does this help them control the population? Why do they need it? There's 6.7 billion people in the world. You can't control 6.7 billion people unless they believe what you tell them. If they all rebel against you, you're done. No one can hold down a rebellion of a million. let alone a billion, let alone 6 billion. So the reason they need this cap and trade nonsense, the reason they need the climate change stuff to go with it, is so that people will willingly follow into this plan, because when you look at it from a mathematical and economic standpoint, nobody benefits except the biggest corporations in the world. And I'll tell you what, you know, all the Republicans that hate cap and trade today, you know when they'll like it? Once it's in play, and all of their buddies are making tons and tons of money with it, and they start doing options, because, guys, come on, have you learned nothing? Do you not think, you know how we had all this real estate, and it was all junk real estate, and then they made a bunch of options on it, and they packaged that up, and they sold it, and then they insured against it, and they sold it again, and they leveraged it 40-1, and one Joe that bought a house he couldn't afford, couldn't pay for it, the whole Ponzi scheme collapsed, and we had this giant recession? Don't you think they're gonna have options trading? Don't you think that they're going to have derivatives trading for carbon? And they have it for every other major commodity in the world. You're going to create the biggest one ever. They're not going to do derivatives trading with carbon. This is a money scheme. That is all this is. If you believe in carbon being evil, find another way to solve your problem. If you don't believe it, that's fine. I don't believe it. I think it's a bunch of nonsense, but I think we're polluting the hell out of the planet. Find another way to solve the pollution problem. This doesn't do it. Hopefully that answers it. Again, it doesn't matter what you believe about the climate. That won't change what cap and trade is, how it works, and what it economically does to the global economy. Figure that out before you just blindly follow anything. All right, next question. Question comes from Frank. Frank wants to know, Frank says, hey, Jack, I hear you talking about these credit cards, and I agree with you, but I got the impression that you actually think we should, like, not use them at all. And I think it's crazy, and we should just use them responsibly. There's no responsible way to use a flamethrower in your house, Frank. Let's go into the rest of your question, because you asked a good one. He says, what is my take? Some insurance companies actually base your rates in part on your FICO score. So if you don't have credit cards, you have a low FICO score. That's your credit score. And since you have a low credit score, due to that fact, you will end up paying more for your insurance. What's my take on that? First of all, these discount points from insurance companies, don't over-believe in them. We had one with State Farm, because we had all our insurance with State Farm, including our homeowner's insurance. And then we shopped for homeowner's insurance, and we found we could get a better rate on homeowner's insurance at State Farm. They wouldn't meet it. They said, well, you're going to lose your discount. We said, fine. We switched, and the discount we lost was $7 a year. The discount we lost was $7 a year. Now, this is not mathematical loss in, like, okay, well, we saved $300, and then it cost us $293, so we were $7 in the hole at the end of this. This was, of all the insurance other than homeowners, our rates went up $7 a year. And then the homeowners came down by what we saved, which was several hundred dollars a year. So a lot of these discounts, safe driver discounts, auto theft discounts, this stuff adds up to $5, $6 a month maximum. To me, that's not worth bringing a pit viper into your home that could bite you. So, yes, Frank, I believe you should not have a credit card, period. Now, if you say you got it, do it for your FICO score. I think you're wrong. But you know what? Fine. I'll humor you. Then how would I do that? I would go get myself a nice, crispy credit card, and I would get that nice, free credit card statement with no interest and what have you on it. And as soon as the nice, pretty credit card came, I would walk into my shredder, okay, and I would take that credit card and I would shred it into tiny little pieces in a special hole in my shredder that's made just for destroying credit cards. So I have a shredder that has three little holes, one for paper, one for DVDs and CDs, and one for cards. And I would shred it into tiny little pieces of confetti. And then I would say, see, I have a credit card. It's not in my wallet. I can't use it, but I get a credit card statement every month. So on paper, I have a credit card. So if you absolutely felt you had to do it, that's how I do it. And you still don't have any reason to put the damn thing in your wallet. Credit cards are a scam as well. They have interest rates that should be illegal. They change the rules on you in midstream. Your frequent flyer points, your discount points, or your points for whatever are bullshit. You're only lying to yourself. If you still want one after I tell you all this, fine. That's okay. Don't comment on my blog and don't beg me to bless you and don't try to explain to me how you're right. You're wrong. I'm right on this one. Now, you have your own life, your own choices. You're free to do what you want with them. I'll still drink beer with you. But if you're walking around paying for anything with a real Visa card, not a bank card, then you're screwing up your financial future, period. And even if you're doing it right now and nothing's going wrong, you're like the guy walking on the tightrope blindfolded. You might be able to walk across once or twice, but sooner or later you're going to fall. It is an inherent danger that doesn't belong in your home, and I think that we as Americans today owe our families more than to bring pit vipers into our homes. And I did it, and we got bit, and I'll never, ever do it again. And as soon as you get it out of your life, as soon as you get rid of it, as soon as it's gone, as soon as you go to pay for something, it's either a debit card or a check or cash. As soon as you do that, you'll realize it was all a scam and you never needed it. If you think I'm wrong, humor me. Get rid of your credit cards, cancel the accounts, do everything. If you have good credit, and you want a new credit card, they'll give you one. Live that way for 30 days. See if anything bad happens. When nothing bad happens, and you have more money, and you have an emergency fund, etc., you'll realize that what I've been telling you is true all along. What about an emergency? Have an emergency fund. Save money. If you can't save up $1,000 cash to keep in a little savings account or a jar somewhere, you can't afford a credit card. That's just reality. If you can't save up $1,000 cash, you definitely cannot afford a credit card. So if you tell me, I can't save up $1,000, you better not have a credit card. And anybody that gives you a credit card, if you can't save up $1,000 over a few months, is a retarded baboon to give you a credit card when you can't save up $1,000. Okay. I'm worked up now. Let's go to the next one. Mark asked me, what about saving and filtering and recycling motor oil? That he's heard that motor oil never actually goes bad, it just gets dirty. And you can filter it through, you know, a fine filtered micron cloth and then maybe take out any metal fragments with a magnet and just reuse the oil. Can that be done? Will it work? And is it true that oil never breaks down? You can do it. It will work. If you had a whole ass load of oil that had run 3,000 to 5,000 miles only in vehicles, and a post shit hit the fan, it would probably filtered out and ready to go and ready to reuse in multiple ways, not just as motor oil, but maybe as a fuel, because it will burn. It would probably be a reasonable commodity in a shit hit the fan scenario, a big one where, you know, you can't get oil, you can't get gas, that type of thing. I think it'd have some value there. But is it true that the oil never breaks down and only gets dirty? Absolutely not. That's bullshit. And this I speak, you know, I know of where I speak, so to say, from my background and my history as a mechanic. You mentioned them doing this in the Army. It doesn't get done in today's Army. It got done in wartime where oil was very difficult to come by, and people were in rationing in this country through, like, World War II. It got done. There was some recycling of oil going on at the point in time in combat scenarios and in situations and deployments where supplies were thin. And it was done because it was better to filter and recycle the oil than to just leave it in there and not do anything at all. That's why it was done. It wasn't done because it was just as good. It doesn't stop being oil. You can run oil until it's completely useless, and it's still oil. It's still petroleum. It'll still burn. It'll still have some lubricity or lubrication properties to it. But what happens to oil over time is its viscosity breaks down. So what is viscosity? It's the way that oil flows. It's this lubrication properties. And when you look at oil and you see like 10W30, 5W30, 10W40, what they're talking about there is the weight of the oil. That's really related to its viscosity or how thick it is. So what happens to oil over time is that thickening of it is bad, but it's not the thickening that you're thinking of. In other words, when I pour fresh oil out of a container, it's quite thick. It pours like syrup. That's because it has viscosity. right? That's because it is a lubricant, right? And if I filter out all the sludge, that different type of thickening is removed. But then what happens is if I do that enough times and I run the oil long enough and I filter it well enough and I have that filtered oil and I take a nice fresh thing of freshly made oil and I take my filtered oil and I pour them side by side, the filtered oil will be a lot thinner. It'll have less viscosity than the unfiltered oil. What that means is its ability to lubricate has broken down. See, we don't just change our oil because it becomes sludged up and nasty. In fact, if you change your oil at a regular maintenance schedule, you look at your oil, it doesn't really look that bad. It might be a lot blacker, but it doesn't have clumps of crap in it or anything like that, right? So why we're changing it is more about its viscosity, its ability to lubricate being lost. So the thought that it never breaks down, just wrong. I don't know where you got the information, but it's incorrect. Okay, next question, Ryan. This is an important one, folks, because I don't want this guy to blow his brains out. I already answered him by email the day I got the question. Ryan got a hold of an old Remington 760 pump-action rifle, caliber 280 Remington. First question's pretty easy. How do I remove a little bit of surface rust? WD-40 and triple O steel wool. Spray a little WD-40 on the rifle, rub it gently with triple O steel wool, gently, not hard. You don't want to try to rub hard, try to start pulling bluing off of it. But do that two or three times. Give it some time with a little WD-40 sitting on the surface rust. It'll be gone, especially if it's surface rust. If it's pitted rust and it's into the steel, it's going to be more involved to get rid of it. If you do end up with a little bit of the bluing missing because of the rust, there's a product called PermaBlue. It's not great, but it's decent for touching up little spots. I would try to blue an entire handgun with it, but for just little surface area stuff, it'll actually make an old weapon look pretty damn good. You might have to redo it once in a while, but it's a good product. So if you do have to remove that surface rust, have some exposed steel, clean it really good with a solvent so you remove all oil from it, apply PermaBlue two or three times, buff the PermaBlued spot with the steel wool, and that'll blend it in so it doesn't look any different than the bluing around it, and you'll have a nicely refurbished little rifle there. He also says one of the sights are missing. Didn't say front or back. Where do I get parts for my guns? The company is called Brunel's. Brunel's has everything for gun parts. You probably get them at Midway USA, but I guarantee you any part you need, Brunel's has it. I'll put a link in today's show notes for anybody that needs firearms parts. The next one is the one that scared me. You're going, where's he going to blow his brains out at? Here you go. He asked me, he always hears people talking about different rounds and cartridges, and he actually wants me to do a show on this, and I probably will. Now that I realize that maybe there's some misunderstanding here about cartridges and terminology and rounds and appropriate calibers and things like that. But he looked up on Wikipedia and saw that his rifle, his 760, doesn't just fire 280s, it can fire 7mm and 30-06s. No, it can't. The 760 as a model comes in multiple calibers. You can buy one in 280 Remington. You can buy one in 30-06. You can buy one in 243 Winchester. The problem with 30-06 is it's 30 caliber. Your weapon is 280. That's 28 caliber. And if you actually manage, and it would be difficult, but if you manage to cram a 30-06 round into the chamber and fire it, you would at minimum blow out the side of your barrel and possibly cause yourself an undue amount of pain and harm with that rifle. You can't fire 30-06s in a 280, and you can't fire anything that your individual rifle's not specified for. On the barrel of every rifle, it will give you what goes in that rifle, and nothing else ever goes in there. Now, the reason I did this question, I thought it'd be interesting to take a little cartridge history today and learn about a great American cartridge that never was and never has been in the minds of the American shooter. The 280 Remington is an interesting cartridge. It was created basically by necking down the .30-06 to .28 caliber, and .28 caliber happens to be exactly the same at 7 millimeters. Okay, so we've got a .280, which is also a 7 millimeter round as far as the caliber. Not called the 7 millimeter, but it has a 7 millimeter bullet. Hopefully that makes sense to folks. Alright, so we have our 7mm bullet in our .30-06, our .28 caliber bullet in our .30-06. And what do we end up with? We end up with a great cartridge. We end up with a cartridge that will fire most bullet weights very, very close to 7mm magnum velocities, within 100 to 200 feet per second. And in the field, that's a very negligible difference. So we get something with 7mm magnum capability without the heavy recoil of 7mm magnum in a standard length action, and we have a great round. And because it's 28, 280, and Americans aren't really familiar with it, it doesn't really go anywhere, it doesn't take off, it just kind of flops from a marketing perspective. It performs beautifully, and the people that use it love it, but it doesn't sell well. So some marketing genius in the 80s decides that, hey, we got to take another run with this thing. So they decide, well, Americans like 7mm. 7mm Mauser sells well. 7mm Magnum sells well. It's a much more familiar thing. So instead of calling it a 280, let's call it the 7mm Remington Express. That sounds like a great marketing term. And it flopped. So they decided there was enough guns out there that fired it, and it was a good round, and it made sense to keep it around, but the 7mm Remington Express probably hurt things more than helped things, because people were now confused, which ammo do I use in my rifle? So after a very short experiment, they changed the name back to the 280 Remington. The cartridge never changed, and that probably was its death nail of really becoming something popular, and because of that, the 270, which is one caliber lower, and the .30-06, which is two calibers higher, have always seemed to outperform the 280 from a standpoint of sales. But I'll tell you what, if you want a really good frickin' rifle, a 280 Remington is an amazing balance point between going to that lighter caliber like the 270, keeping some of the heavier bullet weights in the punch of a .30-06, and extending the effective range of the rifle. It is an amazing round, and what it's capable of is pretty awesome. In fact, one thing people don't really realize about a lot of ammunition is when you hear like a so-and-so Magnum, right? Well, those Magnum rifles always end up with these long, giant 26-inch barrels to make efficient use of that powder. And then most of your sporter rifles are 22 to 24-inch barrels. And most of them are 22s. So you take that 280, you put it down in a 22-inch barrel, and it ends up 150 feet per second behind a 7mm Magnum. Well, a guy did an experiment. He put a 26-inch barrel on a 280, and the difference between the 7mm Magnum and the 280, even with a lot less powder being burned, was almost imperceivable. That's what the efficiency of that round is capable of. So you got a great gun. My first deer rifle was a Remington 760 and .30-06. I'd love to have it back. It's gone to the ages of time. Clean it up, make it nice, but don't put anything but 280s in there. Justin asked me a complex question. He's got 1 year left to pay on his car, no other debt. They want to buy some land, and they want to get his wife out of being employed and into running her own business. And she's a hairstylist, a hairdresser. Great plan. Got to figure out how to do it to make it work for you. I can only give you some ideas. You still have to make it work for you. You're in your own situation. And they're up in Boston, and I know that Justin doesn't mind this because it's a comment from the blog, and he put Justin in Boston on his signature. So my big concern is your cost of living in Boston is huge. And unless you're married to the area, I'd look elsewhere. I really would. I don't like Boston from a standpoint of what's going to happen if we have a real, even a regional shit hit the fan up there. It's a pretty tough city to deal with an emergency, and if you ever have a really big one, and the cost of living is insane. And you know, if you like it there, then stay. But all things being equal, I'd recommend you start looking for some places, at least outside of Boston, and maybe outside of Massachusetts. You might want to look at moving to New Hampshire with the Free State Project. right, let's try to take this and break it down. One, the car loan. If you had 4 years on your car loan and it was a good car and you were going to keep it, I would say maybe let's pay the car down a lot before we look at buying a house. One car payment, as long as you're not going to immediately go buy a second car payment, buying some land or a house, I'm okay with. What they want to do, though, is buy land that eventually built. That's often more expensive. Or at the very least, what you may want to do is buy a very small, maybe old, maybe a house that really is in need of going away, being taken down. But already, you know, then you have your electrical and all your, everything's ready to go to build a new house. And maybe you can make it work temporarily. That might be a better way to go. Or buy a piece of land. And I know there's a stigma in the Northeast, especially against mobile homes. But throw a little mobile home and live on there for a while instead of paying rent and for the land. That worries me a bit, putting yourself in that situation, unless your income's really, really solid. But again, now we're talking about moving the wife into her own business, which is a tough transition. That said, I think anybody, if you're a hair cutter, a hairstylist, whatever you want to call yourself, a beautician, you should be in business for yourself. There's very little that, you know, pro cuts or super cuts brings to the table, other than a steady paycheck. But even if you're going to be successful in that environment, and even if it's the Vidal Sassoon Salon or something like that, in any of those situations, if you're going to be successful, you're going to have your own regulars, people that come in that always want you, that give you volume, that tip you, that type of thing. So you might as well do that for yourself. It'll take a little bit longer, but in the end, you'll be a lot more happy. You'll be a lot more independent. And it is possible anywhere on the planet. I remember when I first moved to Northampton, Pennsylvania, I went to this little barber shop, and I walked in. There were a couple guys waiting to get their hair cut. One guy getting his hair cut. It was an old barber, you know, barber pole, things like that. And I was looking at the guy's hair. He was almost done with it. It was really, he was doing a great job. I thought, man, I found a great old-fashioned barber. This is awesome. This is great that we're moving back to the country. And the guy looks at me, and he says, I'm sorry, I only do haircuts by appointment. And this was like, you know, like four old men sitting there waiting for this barber to cut their hair. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, this place looks pretty cool. Can I make an appointment with you now for next week or something? I'd like to start using you. And he said, I'm sorry, I'm not taking new customers. I said, what? He said, I'm sorry, I'm not taking new customers. I have all the business I can handle. I haven't taken new customers for 4 years. So if he can do it in Northampton, you can do it anywhere. So I think you get a lot of freedom by building that business. I would do that. Now, exactly what order and what priority put them, you got to really do that for yourself. In an ideal situation, you might really want to knock the car out. If it's only a year, double down on it. Make it 6 months. Be totally free of debt. Look for that piece of land. Now, in an ideal situation, I would try to buy a piece of land or a piece of property or a home that's in a good location to run my hair cutting business out of my home, with the exception is I would probably put in a separate structure for my salon. Even if it's a small little, like, you know, one of those buildings that they, like prefab buildings or something, so I'd want enough land to do that. That's how I would do it, because you have no commute, your cost of ownership is pretty much the same once you absorb the construction cost, which can be done very, very low. You're going to probably put as much money into the equipment as you are into the structure. It doesn't have to be a real fancy salon. And kind of play up that it's different like that. And you know, in the beginning, you're begging for business. But as you get enough business to float, then start to be exclusive with the customers you take. Take good customers. There's plenty of heads to cut hair on. You only need, you know, a few dozen a day or less than that. Probably, you know, half a dozen a day to make a really good living as a good stylist. So get yourself into that mode and that frame of mind. That's the best I can do there. And that applies to anybody. When you're thinking about these things, like I want land, I want a business, you have to kind of find ways to make them synergistic and make them work together. Next question. Steve wants to know about currency exchange. I'm going to do this one quick because I'm running out of time today. But basically, Steve's saying, hey, look, what if they ever do devalue the currency and replace it with new money? So they come out and they say, the old dollar is dead. Now we have the Amero, and it's a 2-to-1 exchange. So that what that will mean is that if you have $100,000 and you turn it in, you get 50,000 Ameros. What will that do to the debt? Will the debt devalue along with the currency's devaluation? Yeah. Yes, probably, most likely, almost certainly, maybe. Sorry, I can't be more specific than that. But basically what he's saying is, does that mean that the mortgage on my house, let's say I owe $40,000 left on the mortgage on my house, will I now own 20,000 Amaros? We're in a very hypothetical world here, but most likely, yes. Most likely, all domestic debt would devalue with the currency because it would revalue against the currency. And it's, in a way, what happened with the gold standard being removed by Roosevelt. Because gold was trading at $37 and you got 20, and a $20 bill was still buying basically what a $20 gold piece was buying. So effectively it devalued. So most likely, yes. Now, here's the thing. What about foreign debts? If you owe a company, if your company owes a company in Europe $100,000 and $100,000 gets devalued to 50,000 Amaros, they may very well want 50,000 or 100,000 Amaros, depending on how the currency exchange works. And that's too hypothetical to go into. But I want to put it to you another way. It's already happening. It happens every day with the way things are. Your currency gets devalued every day through inflation. And your debt devalues along with it. So if you have $100,000 in cash and you owe $100,000 on your house, a year from now, if we have 6% inflation, effectively you have $96,000 worth of cash. Right? It says $100,000, but it'll only buy what $96,000 would have bought or $94,000 would have bought last year, depending on the inflation rate. But it'll still pay off your house because the debt is devaluing as the currency devalues. But it's getting harder and harder to make the money as well. So it doesn't work out positively for you at all. But that's how inflation works right now. Next one. Adam has a question. Let's see. Grandmother and mother have houseplants. They move in every winter, and they move out, you know, whenever it's nice enough to put them outside. None of them produce anything edible. Are there any dwarfed fruit trees that they could do that with? And what about Grandma, since she doesn't have anybody to help her? Some really cool things to do this with would be citrus. Some of the citruses you could look at would be your loquats, your kumquats, mandarins, things like that. Now, they're actually hardy, a lot of them down into 20 degrees, and some of them down to 10. So they don't necessarily have to come in. And this guy said he's in Arkansas, so you may not even have to bring them in. But you probably want to, because you need that warmth to help them bear and ripen fruit. As far as Grandma and how she can move them in and out, put them on a roller caddy. They make beautiful little wooden plant boxes with great little wheels on them, and you just push them in, and Grandma can push them in just like you could go out there and carry them. In fact, I would advise you, if you want to do it for yourself, put the little rollers on them himself. He wanted me to kind of give a rundown of dwarf fruit trees that'll do well in Arkansas. I can't do that today in the show. We'll talk about that and maybe more dwarf fruit trees in general in a show coming up. But as far as things to bring in the house, your small citruses, your patio peaches will do well. Most of your dwarf apples are either going to get too big for that, even though they call them dwarfs, or if they're that small, they're not going to produce well. They're probably not going to be really worth the effort. Dwarf peaches will do quite well. I would go with your dwarf citruses, and your loquats, your kumquats, and your mandarin, you don't have to worry about dwarf varieties. They're kind of a dwarfing tree to begin with. You can prune them and keep them there. But the other thing is, think about things that you can do with plants that aren't necessarily trees that look good. Swiss chard, spinach, and lettuces, the different colors of lettuces. You can make some really beautiful-looking containers out of that stuff, and you can cut it and use it as you need it, and as it starts to go to seed, replace the plants as they get too mature to produce well for you anymore. And you can do a lot with that throughout the year, inside and outside, so think about that too. Next one is from a guy named Chuck. And he has an interesting question. Basically, he says, hey, could a lot of shooting near a well infect the well with lead poisoning? So he was shooting about 30 feet away from his well. And, you know, it's like, I'm not firing thousands and thousands of rounds into the ground or anything, but could that lead end up down in my water in my well? His well's only about 50 foot deep. Probably not. There'd have to be some kind of freak, you know, crevice or something for the stuff to get down. The water at 50 feet down in your well is not the rain that lands on your property. That water's running off and going far away before it ever gets anywhere. Lead can be an issue, and you may want to think about how you can recoup your lead. A good range, you might want to put in a great big sand berm, and that makes it pretty easy to go through the sand every once in a while and pull a lot of that stuff back out of there. And if you do a lot of lead casting and shoot a lot of 22s, you can actually use that lead and recycle it and recast it. But I wouldn't worry about firing a few rounds out the back door and having it get into your well. There's probably other things that you need to worry about getting into your well a lot more than a few rounds like that. 50 feet down is a long way down for water to go. And there's pathways for it to get there, but they're almost never straight down. You use elevation changes and formations and things like that allow water to get that deep. So I wouldn't worry about it. Andrew says, should keeping dental work up to date be a big thing for preppers? Because if you have a really bad tooth that's hurting bad, it could be a real nightmare, even in a minor shit at the fan, if you just can't get to the dentist for a couple weeks. Damn straight. It makes me think of the movie, what was it, Castaway, where the guy has a bad tooth and he ends up stuck on the island, and he eventually ends up slamming the tooth out of his mouth with an ice skate from the stuff that washed up on shore, hitting it with a rock. I've seen teeth extracted. I don't think that would have worked, but I could understand why you would get that desperate and do it. I had a tooth that abscessed on me one time, and the pain was unbelievable. And I learned something about abscesses, though, with a tooth. If it's an abscess that's inflaming the gum, I couldn't get to a dentist that day. They wouldn't take me. And I had to go another day. And eventually, I looked at that big swollen gum, and I heated up a needle to sterilize it, and I poked the gum. And as you might imagine, this is disgusting, but pus came out of it, and it tasted bad and smelled worse. But I rinsed my mouth out with salt after that, and most of the pain was gone. So there's a little, self-dental. If you end up with that type of, now not all types of abscesses abscess that way. Sometimes there's no, it doesn't come out the side, and there's no way to relieve the pressure other than a dentist. So keeping your dental hygiene up to date, really, really important. He also said that he thinks that everything, all the bug out bags should have like Orajel in them for like temporary pain relief. But he made a little comment I think I thought I would comment on here myself in his like end of his statement. It said, even though I think you should always try to plan to bug in except for a worst case scenario. Bugging out has nothing to do with a bug out bag, folks. Let me say that again. Bugging out has nothing to do with a bug out bag. Bugging out is leaving your house. You better take more than your bug out bag if you leave your house. A bug out bag is not really for leaving. It is to provide support for you for 3 or more days, if you can make it 4 more days, while you get from a point of danger to a point of safety. It may very well be supporting you while you load up everything you can take and bug out to a bug out location. It may be supporting you while you temporarily shelter in some type of shelter provided for you, because in the scenario you end up in, you have no other choice, and God, I don't want to end up there, but it could happen, and we got to be realistic about it. And it may do a lot of different things for you, but it is never something that you pack up your bug out bag and go live in the woods. That's nonsense. It's hyperbole. It's bullshit. And it's a great way to make a bad situation worse. So, having Orajel in your bug out bag is a great idea, and anything else that can be used for first aid, dental or otherwise, is a great idea. But it may very well be that your bug out bag's purpose ends up being in a disaster to get you from where you spend a third of all your time during the week, your job, to where you need to be, home. And I really hope people understand that about bug out bags, because it bugs me, pun not intended, whenever anybody talks about bug out bags, and they only see the bug out bag as a means to aid bugging out. It's not what it's about, folks. It's about providing at least 72 hours of support for yourself, and that may be support that you use certain very specific things in a bug out bag while you're in your home. But most likely, and the reason we make them a bag and we make them mobile and we make them something that can stay in a toolbox in a truck or stay in the back of a car or the trunk of a car, is so that it's always with you. So that you, if you end up in a bad situation, you have the opportunity to get from that bad place to a place that is a better place to ensure your survival, ensure the survival of those around you. Last question is a tough one, and I'm not going to have a real answer for it. Just some thoughts on it. Guy's name's Ken. He's 55, but he's in perfect health. Doesn't really go to the doctor much, not on any real maintenance medications, and hence, to try to cut the expenses of life, he's cut his insurance to a $1,000 deductible and only hospitalization. So basically, he's got catastrophic insurance. Even that's costing him $225 a month. He says there's got to be ways to do this outside of, quote, the system, unquote. Yeah, there is, but the problem is that the government doesn't want us to. They don't want to solve the health care problem. This health care reform stuff and everything around it from both sides of the aisle is complete bullshit. They don't want to fix the problem. They want to capitalize on the problem. Governments always seek to increase power, to use tragedy as an opportunity, and to control. That's what they do. Governments control. And that is, unfortunately, in the minds of our government servants today, their job. They think they're supposed to control. They think that's what we need. They think that self-governance is an old idea that didn't quite work out. We've evolved the country into something more. They believe that the government controlling us is what made America move from the world of a third world nation to a first world nation and made us the world power. It is not. We became what we are because of self-governance. And we've been hampered ever since that started to be eroded. And what does that have to do with healthcare? It has everything to do with healthcare. There was this doctor up in Washington, and this is what he said. For a family of up to four people, for $125, you can come see me for anything. I will not give you a bill. Any lab work that I can do in-house, I will do myself. Any lab work that goes outside, I'll work with the labs, and I'll make sure that you get a cash price that's better than an insurance price. And if you need to go to a hospital or something like that, carry catastrophic. But basically, $125 for a family of four. And if you're a single person, $75. You pay me that every month, whether you see me or not. But if you need me, I'm always here. Worked beautifully until the state put him out of business because they said he was running an insurance company. There's your solution to day-to-day health care. Doctors being able to charge a retainer and the fair market value being set by what people are being willing to pay. And if you get a better doctor, his retainer is going to be higher. Just like if you get a better lawyer, his lawyer is going to be more expensive. Now, there is something called legal insurance, but it doesn't do very well. It doesn't sell very well, and nobody sees it as an inherent right. Why? Is it because people never use a lawyer? No. Is it because people's life never depend on a lawyer? Absolutely not. Right? You can say whatever you want about the public defenders, and you can always get an attorney and whatever, and most of them suck. Just like a public doctor would suck. But when somebody needs a lawyer, they go out and they get a lawyer, and they pay a market rate for that lawyer, and if they're a better lawyer, they pay a higher market rate. If we would let the medical establishment set up programs for people like that, that would solve a lot of the problem. And, of course, this guy was threatened with jail if he didn't cease and desist immediately. Now, that's a creative solution. That's something that most people could afford. And if you don't think your doctor is worth $125 a month, I'm sorry. There's a reason that the man goes to school, gets a degree, and then goes to medical school and gets certified as a doctor, and then does 2 years of internship before he can practice. There's a reason that these guys have 8 to 10 years of education before they're allowed to do their jobs. And that means you have to pay for their services. I'm sorry, or those people are not going to go into that line of work anymore, and they're not going to do that line of work anymore. We're not going to have them. So there's one solution. I also think that there's a tremendous opportunity for hospitals to be set up in better ways. But I think as long as the government's getting in the way, as long as people are able to sue for $10 million because of a mistake that didn't really harm the individual for the rest of their life. You know, if a doctor does something that's completely negligent, I'm all for that guy getting his ass sued. But people sue over the drop of a hat today. As long as we're taking care of people in our medical establishments that contribute nothing, and we're saying that those people have a right to care, not just life-saving care, but I'm all for it. If you're dying, yes, we have to save you. Whatever it takes, we have to say, if we can, we should save you. Period. End of story. And we do that now. But we're moving into a very dangerous world now, where if you have a skinned knee or a sore finger, or a cold, you have a right to go get medical treatment for that. And what's going to happen is we're going to have rationing and problems. So, Ken, I don't know what the solution is, man. Other than I'd like to see doctors creating their own solutions. And you could say that the government will always get in the way, but let's get some doctors together. And let's let them start create some solutions. And let's see if we can figure out a way that they can create those solutions the government won't get in the way of. Let's make the shot at it. I can see doctors putting together a practice and saying we only do business in cash. I would like to see, here's what I'd like to see. I think this is a great idea. And all you guys that want to know what kind of business to put together, hey, go put this business together. Don't come to me and ask me for money to do it. Go do it. Go figure it out. Why not put together a doctor's network of doctors that take only cash? And they charge what the insurance companies would pay them, but they get the cash today instead of the insurance company and Medicaid's money down the road. Just like, you know, like when you go get your HMO or your PPO or whatever the crap you have, and you go, is the doctor in the network? And you go type in your zip code, and it shows you all the doctors that are in your network. Why don't somebody create a network of doctors that only take or will take cash at insurance rates? So I can go, I feel sick today, I need to go to a doctor. Let me go find a doctor that will take cash and have their rates published. Office visit, X dollars. Blood test, X. Right, so it's the name, the doctor, his credentials, his contact information, and a standard rate, a standard fee schedule, what he will charge the public. I can't see how anything about that would the government could really get in the way of. So why don't one of you entrepreneuring people out there that want to build something online, go build that. There's a fortune in that if you go out and build it right. Okay, with that, this has been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
You can scream, and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.